Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like I'm standing on the shoulder of giants. And I mean that in the sense that today's episode feels very historical. And we are thinking about an artist. We're going to be exploring his life and work. And he passed away many years ago. And he is someone that I sort of feel like is a forefather to everything that you and I have gone on to be, both within our personal lives, but also within our passion for art. And the artist we're going to be talking about is called Larry Stanton. And he was born in 1947 and then passed away in 1984. And that was when you and I were just like 3 years old or something, or 2 years old. We were really, really young. And he was based in Manhattan in New York. And there's also a lot of parallels with all the research that you've been doing for your recent acting roles, particularly in American Horror Story. Because I know that you've been looking a lot at the kind of 80s and 70s and 60s within New York, and particularly the kind of artistic scene that happened at that time. And we will explore some amazing stories. But the person that we are meeting today was Larry's partner and champion, and is someone that has, in a way for me, is so important because he has protected and taken care of the guardian for this historical body of work that is so extraordinary. It's predominantly portraiture, and of a time where many young men died from AIDS and were lost, and there's a whole generation that live on in these artworks. And it is such a great privilege for us to meet today's guest. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art Arthur Lambert. Hi, Arthur.
Hello.
Where do you find you, Arthur? Where are you in the world?
On 9th Street in Manhattan.
How long have you lived in New York? How long has New York been your address?
1972. Previous to that, I was living in Los Angeles.
And what was it about New York that made you want to move there specifically?
Well, my partner moved back to New York. He was living with me in California. And his father had a rent-controlled apartment, which he was giving up. But in order to get the apartment, which was like $45 a month, he had to actually be living there. So he came back. And then I had started a business with a classmate of mine in Washington, D.C., really suburban Maryland. But it was a bank and it was small. So I got this offer to go to Los Angeles. So I asked Larry if he'd like to go. So he said yes. So we moved to Los Angeles. That was 1968. And he was there about a year and a half before he had to come back for his apartment. And in about 2 years, the people that ran this business in Chicago learned from one of the answering services ladies that I was gay. They were horrified. They got on a plane the next morning, flew straight to Los Angeles, and fired me. As that gay people can't run businesses, they obviously didn't know about the guy who runs Apple.
Who was that who run Apple that was out?
The guy who runs it now.
Oh, it's Tim Cook.
Yeah, Tim Cook.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think of Tim Cook as being his sexuality on any level. I just think of his brain, but yeah.
Anyway, no, totally. Yeah.
After amazing. I was fired, I stayed in California another year. I really liked it. This was late 1960s, and it was different from today because in those days, I lived in the hills, but if you wanted to go somewhere, you got in your car and you went. It took 15, 20 minutes. Now, if you do the same thing, it takes you an hour to 2 hours.
God. So we're talking about, so you said about your partner, and this is Larry Stanton, the artist that we're talking about today and celebrating. And as Rob said, you were his champion, but you were his partner, his mentor. You've been described as his adoptive father. You were obviously his close friend. And now you're a representative of this estate. And Larry was Manhattan-based like yourself now, and he was a portrait artist, and faces were the thing for him. What was New York like then, and how did you meet Larry Stanton? How did you come into each other's lives?
Well, I met him in 1967. New York gay community then was relatively small. I mean, you had Harold Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, a lot of people that were famous, and it was all, you met them all because it was such a small community. Well, when he arrived, he worked at a coffee bar, you know, milkshake bar, and people saw him, and they were so taken by his attractiveness that the word spread in the gay community that someone unusually attractive had arrived in New York who was gay. So I was dying to meet him. I didn't know how. At that time, he was 19. I was 33. So I didn't know, you know, what the opportunities were. But anyway, I was having lunch at Fire Island Cafe that overlooks the harbor and the boardwalk. And lo and behold, he appeared right on the boardwalk in front of us. So I got up. I ran out. All my friends said I looked unbelievably nervous, shifting back. But anyway, I talked to him, and I had a little cottage there. I said, if you need a couch to stay on, you know, you can stay at my place. So he did, and that was the beginning. And then when I got this job in Los Angeles, I thought it'd be great if he came with me. But when we got to Los Angeles, I saw I was 34, he's 19. I'm suddenly thinking, this is a huge responsibility. I've got a kid that's just starting his life out. I asked him what he wanted to do. He said he wanted to be an artist. So I thought, well, maybe art school would be a place to start. So I sent him to Art Center, which is the best West Coast art school in that part of the country. So he went there for 2 semesters, I think, and we lived together. And then his father got that apartment he had to come back for. But Los Angeles was great in those days. It was Vietnam War protesters. We used to have parties, and these kids would arrive at our house beaten from these anti-Vietnam protests. So it's kind of an exciting time. And as I say, Los Angeles was small, very anti-gay at the time. If you went to a gay bar, you were in danger because the police would come in and they'd make up. They said you were touching him. But people in those bars were so terrified, there was always like a foot between them. They just made it up. And then they'd drag the person out and charge them. So he went to a bar in Los Angeles that didn't serve alcohol, and it was filled with young kids, and it was perfect for him because he was drinking in New York, and when he went to Los Angeles, he stopped drinking. That was when we met David Hockney, because I knew a dealer in Los Angeles, Nicholas Wilder. David did a number of paintings and drawings of. And he had a very successful gallery. And I knew he knew David, so I asked him whether he could invite him up to my house for dinner. So he did. He went to David and said, I have some friends. They'd really like you to come for dinner. Would you be willing? David said, well, who is this person? And he said, remember what I did before I came to Los Angeles? I said, he's a banker. And David said, why on earth would I ever want to meet a banker? So he came, and Larry, he rang the bell. Larry opened the door, and he told me later, he said, oh, I see. He wasn't coming for the banker.
It's coming for Larry. So Hockney has been, you all became really close friends, and as an artist, Hockney has, you know, had a huge influence on Larry's style, yeah, and Larry's depiction, yeah, in art.
But he's had an influence on so many people. I mean, he's such a brilliant artist. And he and Henry Gelseller, do you know who he was?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'd like to talk about that. So this was like your little crew that you were with. It was you, Larry, David Hockney, and Henry Gelseller, who was a Met Museum curator and an art critic for The New Yorker. Is that right, at some point?
I wrote for a number of magazines, but he was the one who created a contemporary art department at the Met. They didn't have any, hardly any. I mean, it's supposed to be the biggest collection in the world. They didn't have anything from the artists in the 50s, the 60s. So Henry created that. He had a show, I think it was 1970, called, anyway, it was a big show of contemporary art. He took 36 galleries, which is a lot of space. And he had all the artists there. Larry went up every day when they were hanging. He was so fascinated to meet the artists, but he was worried because all of the art in those days was abstract, and that's not what he wanted to do. So he wanted to be known, but he wasn't sure how that would ever happen because he was doing portraits, and portraits weren't that popular in those days, especially portraits of kids. People were afraid to buy them because they thought people would think they were priests. No, because of all the scandal in the Catholic Church. So people didn't start to buy him. So when he was in the hospital, he was only 34. So he wrote a will and he left everything to me. So I went and got all the stuff. I had like 250 paintings and about 450 drawings. He didn't really start painting and drawing until he had his nervous breakdown in late 1979, which came about because he was a beer alcoholic. And the only person in his family that really adored him was his mother, who was quite beautiful. She was Swedish descent, and he always wanted to make her realize that he was somebody. Then when she died, she got cancer in the early mid-70s, and he just couldn't bear to go to see her. So when she died, he was riddled with guilt, and he had a nervous breakdown. And he went to the hospital, he was in the hospital for about 2 years, and he met this wonderful doctor who was black. She was head of psychiatry at St. Vincent. This is in late 60s, it's amazing. I mean, most places, she couldn't even go in the restroom to eat, and to be the head of a big hospital department like that, it's pretty amazing. And she was an amazing person. She took him under her care. Her son had fallen off the roof of her building and was killed. So she sort of felt Larry was her replacement son.
Oh.
She adored him. He was crazy about her.
Oh, bless.
This is Dr. Julia Mayo.
Mayo. Yeah.
Oh, you got just extremely emotional. Thank you for sharing that story. I mean,
sorry.
It's all right. So talking about portraits, because people come into Larry's work now and everyone, it's like a rediscovery. You've had this work, you've protected this work for many years. People come to it now, will see. Yeah, right. So people will see lots of faces.
He sold 7 paintings while he was alive. That was it. People weren't buying boys. And that's what he was interested in. And it's amazing, really, that he was able to. I mean, so he only really worked for the years after his mental collapse. When he got well, he came out, it was like 4 years, all that work that you see is the result of 4 years of work, except for there was one few paintings before, but mostly he was so attractive, he was kept being asked to go on trips by older people. He went to Morocco, to France, the Netherlands with Henry Geldzeller. He went on a safari in Africa with an older boyfriend of somebody I had been seeing. So he got to go all over the world and didn't do a lot for his art because he didn't have time to paint. And then we were visiting David Hockney, I guess, around 79 before he got sick. And Henry Geldzeller was staying there. So that's how we met Henry. And Henry was, for him, was a treasure trove, because Henry, when he was at the Met, as I say, he really founded the Contemporary Art Department. His show took 36 galleries. And he always joked that the operators, the telephone operator at the Met, said to him sort of angrily one time, "Why is it that all the calls we get, 3/4 of the calls we get, are for you?" And he said, "Well, I'm the only one here whose artists are still alive."
Right, yeah. Yeah, that was an amazing show, that. It was called New York Painting and Sculpture, and it was looking from 1940 to 1970, for those who don't know about Henry's work. And it had something like 408 works in 35 galleries with 43 different artists. And at the time, it was quite, not necessarily provocative, but he was definitely a controversial curator, and he was definitely showing people new ideas. And people like Pollock, Stella, you know, Jasper Johns, Mark Rothko, at a time when Andy Warhol, Rauschenberg, at a time when those artists weren't really that well known at all.
Yeah. And he spent every day when he was curator at the Met in an artist studio. He was never at the Met, but he knew the art scene in New York so well. I mean, he knew every artist. He wrote a lot of introductions. If he liked their work, he was very loyal. And he got, I think the Times reviewer gave it kind of a nasty review, but it was a monumental show which created the world of contemporary art for New York.
What was it like going to museum exhibitions and openings with Henry and Hockney as a crew? What was that scene like at the time and moving with them?
I didn't actually go to openings with them. And David didn't go to too many openings. He's not really interested that much in other artists unless they have something to show him. I mean, he's crazy about Van Gogh and Picasso. He only owns one painting, not by him, and that's the Picasso. I remember one time when Henry sent him an artist that Henry liked. We're sitting in David's living room, and the artist is sitting in an armchair. He has a stack of paintings about this thick, and he's showing them to David one at a time. When he got up to about 10, David said, "Oh, very nice, love. Have you seen my work?" And driving up to the studio, the guy looked like he'd just seen a ghost. And then there's that movie of him.
Bigger Splash. The documentary?
No, this is another one called Following David or something. This is by a kid whose parents owned a Greek coffee shop in Baltimore. And his ambition was to have David look at his work and give him encouragement. He spent 3 years on this one drawing, and they made a movie about it. It was a drawing of Marilyn Monroe from the photograph. and he took three arrows. He put some, and there must have been 100,000 lines in it. And it took him 3 years. And I remember David said to him, "Oh, love, have you ever thought of working a bit faster?"
Just completely like undermined it all. So funny. Oh, he just doesn't care, David, does he?
Maybe it was called Waiting for Hockney.
Yeah. I think that's what it was called. It's really.
But you've been in David's work, and he's also painted and drawn Larry a lot and Henry.
He always said that Henry was not interested in photographs of himself. He was interested in seeing how he looked from an artist's brush through an artist's brush. So he said that when he was with Henry, suddenly Henry would freeze, and David knew he wanted to be drawn. So he was drawn by everybody. Actually, Robert Mayflow, who visited us at the island, did photograph him, and I gave it to the museum in Miami.
Wow. So Robert Mayflow, then, like, you were really at the epicenter of, you know, the queer art movement, or art movement, not even queer art, just like...
I mean, he's a celebrity in Los Angeles. People come up to visit him. Cary Grant came up to visit him. The only time I've seen him nervous. I mean, but he had all kinds of other people coming up to visit him, you know, famous people. I mean, he was... Joni Collins was just there about a year ago when I was there. He's so charming. I don't know, have you ever seen... There are two BBC movies on him. The last one, I think it's just called David Hockney. It's a terrific film. He is so charming and interesting and gifted. The movie is just, you can't take your eyes off it. But about 20% of the movie, the BBC used Larry's films, which I thought was kind of neat.
His Super 8s.
Yeah. I mean, no sound, but they used his film because he filmed a lot of David relaxing. He filmed David doing the pool paintings, which he did up at Ken Tyler's upstate New York. He filmed that whole thing. He did great films. And we did a lot of photography, but I did the still shots, and he usually filmed.
So to get back to what everyone can see when they look at a Larry Stanton work now is these faces of family, friends, but you were saying about the boys that he encountered during the nighttime expeditions that he had around and about, but always in New York. It felt like the place, the location of New York was incredibly important, but it was more about the faces than the place. Why do you think portraiture was something that he was compelled to record?
He was very attracted to those kids. And he was fascinated by them. I say it's like now, since they're almost all dead, it's like looking at ghosts. I mean, it's the only representation they have to show they were ever even alive, because 3/4 of them died during the AIDS epidemic, as did Larry. But he went to gay bars and stuff and brought these kids home to draw them, which I think is... It's not easy being drawn. I've been drawn numerous times by David. The last time he was able to manage the drawing, but it took 3 hours. You can't move. He looks at you so intently. It's slightly scary. It was funny. I was there with my current boyfriend. We went out to Venice Beach, and there was a Chinese guy sitting on the boardwalk. Did your portrait in 30 minutes. So I went back today. I said, we met someone who must be a lot better than you. He does his work in 30. You take 3 hours. he's a lot better.
Did Larry always paint from reality? Did he ever give himself any license to embellish the faces? Or?
But mostly he sat sitting across me. He drew. Painting he did it from memory, photographs, but the drawings were direct confrontation, which is why I think, on the whole, the drawings are better.
So when Larry passed, you had all of his estate, you had all of his paintings and his drawings. You had his Super 8 films. You had his sketchbooks. He kept a diary.
Yeah, so there was some advantage of the fact that he wasn't commercial. I mean, he never sold anything. So I had everything when he died.
Was he quite shy about showing his work? Because he didn't exhibit much in his lifetime.
No, he was a little shy. There's always a thing. I mean, you're directly represented there. And, if someone doesn't like it, it's disheartening and kind of immediate. So he was a bit shy, but he didn't get offers of many shows. I mean, we had maybe there were four shows. Henry got him a grant to do Prince, and I think he got a couple of grants. The portrait, there's a PS 91, which is city owned, and they have shows there of artists who aren't very well known, and he had a show there.
So for you, when you had all this work, how did you know, or how did you instinctively feel that you wanted to protect it and live with it? Because you live with his work, you have done for the last like 40 years. What compelled you to keep this work around and to you know, protect it, knowing that it was hopefully going to have a life? Because we're seeing the work now, it's incredible things we can go on to talk about. But at the time, you said that nothing was sold. It's quite a lot of, you know, material to kind of, I guess, be burdened with in some ways.
I mean, I love looking at it, but I thought other people should have that privilege. So I was very anxious to get it out there. So I created a website just to show his work. 5 years later, I added two bits on the website, paintings for sale and drawings for sale. Within 2 hours of putting them up, I had two sales. I mean, I was absolutely amazed. I don't know, were people just sitting on the site? I had no idea how that happened. But that's why I sold quite a lot.
How did you know it was time to sell? If you'd held on to them for that long, how did you know that that was the moment that you could let them go? And was that really emotional for you to then suddenly do that?
No, it was emotional for me to get the work out in people's hands, so that they can bond with it. But, I mean, I had 450 drawings. I mean, how many am I selling on site? It didn't seem to be taking down the collection that much, but it gradually grew, and I eventually sold, I don't know, maybe 1,000 works over the site.
Wow.
And then through Fabio, we got these galleries. So I don't sell them anymore. First thing they wanted me to do was take the selling and drawing.
Disable that link. Yeah.
And this Fabio that you're mentioning is Fabio Cherstich, and he has been very closely involved in kind of letting a whole new generation, in a way, to discover the work of Larry, and has been involved in some beautiful projects, including a really great Appartamento monograph that was recently released. How did you get to meet Fabio?
I met him because he was interested in another artist called Patrick Angus. And Patrick, we had a show of Larry's work after he died that David and Henry curated. And it was funny because a lot of the drawings of boys had their name and phone number on the drawing. And Henry, being, I was very nervous whether that was going to be a problem. But of course, they were all dead. So none of them ever saw anything. Anyway, we never had a problem with that. And this gallery owner, named Charlie Coles, agreed to give up his gallery for the show. Then that first book was published, one by 12 Trees Press, Twin Palm, and that was in the Museum of Modern Art bookstore. And Patrick Angus was working there. He saw the book, and he felt that here was an artist he had so much in common with. They were both figurative artists, realists. He called me up right away and said he loved Larry's work. He wrote a letter to the gallery and said, how thrilled he was that they were putting Larry's work up. And so I became friends with him after that. And of course, he was another one, died of AIDS. And Fabio actually, he hadn't sold much. In fact, we knew the mother who lived in Santa Barbara had a lot of his work. They were very, very anti-gay. Her husband wouldn't have anything to do with his son because he was queer. Didn't want to hear from him again. So the mother lost all contact. Well, when Fabio showed up, she said he was the first gay person she had ever met in her life. And she wanted to know if he were happy and stuff. So she completely changed. And the next time he went, the whole house had been painted white and all of his work all over the wall.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. And then so he has a big collection. Most of it came from the mother. She had no idea that her son had any credentials.
Wow.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
I mean, and Patrick Angus now is, you know, people have discovered him, like rediscovered Hugh Steers, you know, and Larry's part of that conversation. So how did, so Fabio connected with you about the work of Larry's? And then also I knew about Larry's work because I was introduced to it by director, actor Joe Mantello, who's a good friend of mine, and I work with him. And he said that Daniel Cooney Gallery, who I've met, Daniel, is an incredible gallerist in Chelsea, in New York, and in Manhattan. And he's got like amazing works there. And there are so many champions around that when they discover Larry's work, they're just screaming it from the rooftops. And what does that feel like now for you and seeing this happen? And is it a happy, sad, you know, emotional?
No, it's happy. When I was with him at the hospital just before he died, he looked at me, I may get emotional on this, and he said, try to think of something that will help you remember me after I'm gone. Like I would have forgotten him. And then he said, I know, think of me when it thunders. So I said, okay, that sounds great. But then I realized it doesn't thunder every day. And I thought of him every day. After he died for 10 years, I carried flowers over to his apartment and left him on the outside window box. They didn't rent his apartment after he died. I'm sure people wondered why all these flowers turned up in October on his windowsill. But he actually died in September, and the hospital kept him in intensive care for a week after he died. His doctor said, what are you keeping him? He's dead. They kept him. I had to pay for the intensive care. I don't know if that's why they kept him. It wasn't that much in those days. I paid $12,000 a week to keep him in intensive care. And anyway, we had a funeral. It was early in the period when people were dying of AIDS. So the church where the funeral was absolutely jam-packed. I mean, there were people lined up outside who couldn't get in.
Wow. We see a lot of images online of your apartment, Arthur, and you have this incredible glass collection. You've built these shelves which go across windows, so the light seems to kind of gleam through and make them luminous in some ways. They feel like they're Venetian glass. I don't know if that's right or not, but they are incredible.
The Brazilian kid that I was boyfriends with for a while, and there's a glass workshop in New York. So he worked there for 3 years. He made all that glass. And it's not easy because all of those things are done at the end of a pipe. So you have to have people holding them. I mean, they're heavy.
They're like totally hand-blown, yeah.
Very difficult to sell them. But in fact, we didn't sell any. I managed to sell a couple. David bought three. David has the biggest collection of Patrick Angus's work. And that was all partly because he liked the idea and he liked to help out people in need. Patrick Angus was dying of AIDS at that point. So he bought three. I sent them to London. It cost more to send them than it did to make them.
Yeah, I mean, we can see a lot of the influence of Hockney again is very clear in Patrick Angus in the line drawings, especially. You can see that influence there. But Larry also really inspired a lot of people, a lot of the other artists. I know that Alex Katz, there's a current exhibition up at the Guggenheim, and Alex Katz made work with Larry in. Is that correct?
News to me.
I've heard that there's works that Alex made that have Larry's face in, that he was kind of drawn to him. Did they know each other?
Well, there was a painting at a museum in Connecticut, which is by Alex Katz, which had Larry and Nabil Nahas, who was the owner of the apartment, and some girl. It's a three. I have it on my computer, but I can't show it to you now.
Oh, yeah, send it to us. I'd love to see that.
That was his only contact with Alex Katz. I know that Ellsworth Kelly was fast. I mean, he went every day when Henry was hanging that show. So he met every artist. And, of course, he wanted to be recognized, but it was worrisome. Well, none of those people did realistic works. They all did abstract work. And he just wasn't interested in abstract. So it was very hard for him. He always felt he'd never be recognized. So when he asked me in the gallery, I mean in the hospital, if I'd try to see if he could get some recognition, I gave him my word that I would. And this is how it's worked out.
It's incredible. So
I had 40 years I had to wait, but I would have waited forever.
Has everything been documented? That, you know, this publication that you made with Appartamento called Think of Me When It Thunders, like what Larry said to you. And you know, there's incredible works in there, drawings, paintings, photographs. It's an beautiful book. Has everything been documented, or do you still have work that's kind of stacked away that you're waiting to reveal again?
We have one drawing that the Whitneys said that they would take. And I have one painting, and that's all I've got. Everything was sold. I mean, I thought about that. David said, don't sell everything. But that was back in 1984. And because he says, you'll never get it together for a show. Well, we had one show. And at this point in my life, when I did the website, I was probably over 80. So I thought, my time is coming to an end. I better get this stuff out, because I've left it to his sister, who liked him and liked his work. But she had a farm upstate New York. She would have just put it in the barn. And that's it. No one would have ever seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I felt
it's good that it's out there. Yeah.
There's an incredible exhibition within Acne, the brand Acne. There's a, which I think Fabio has been a big player in, a whole solo kind of exhibition within the store in, is it Milan in Italy at the minute? Is that where
we're doing it in every store. Fabio is going to Tokyo for the opening there. They're having it in Seoul, Milan, New York, everywhere they have stores. And in Japan, they've got huge blow-ups of his drawings on the sides. They have those double-decker buses like they have in London, and they've got his work, four on each side of the bus.
Wow.
And they just roll through Tokyo. Somebody should notice.
Yeah. And they, you've done a clothing collaboration with them, and there's like a blanket, there's this beautiful lamp shade that's in there that I think sold out online now. I saw that. I was a bit upset about that. But there's t-shirts. Larry made some t-shirts in his lifetime that were like striped, painted t-shirts.
He gave them to Al. I never knew he did those. He was very close to Alice, which was the Philippine girl who was in his class when he went to art school in L.A. She actually moved to New York after he came back, and they were inseparable. I mean, he loved her. He just wasn't attracted to women.
And Alice and you have become very, very close. This is Alice Sillett, who was his dear friend, and he painted her. I mean, the only two women he painted were his therapist, Julia Mayo, and Alice.
And he did his sister.
Oh, his sister.
A nice sister. Actually, I think he painted the nasty sister too. I mean,
yeah, because he did do a series of family paintings, didn't he?
Yeah, did his father. I'm not sure if he did his mother. That was such a difficult relationship. Her aunt was Hilary Brook, who was a big star in the silent film industry. And in fact, when Larry was living with me in Los Angeles, sister called Hilary Brook and told him her nephew was living in Los Angeles. So she came up to see us. It was like Sunset Boulevard. Car, the driver was open, and then she sat in the back, very grand. She came out and saw Larry, and they got along, but she never came back. That was sort of funny. But Henry Gelzer said something which I guess sounds kind of braggadocio, but he said that Larry was so beautiful that when you looked at him, it was like looking at the sun, which is kind of an interesting image, but very Henry.
Yeah. What is your ambitions now, Arthur, for the work? Like, there's incredible things happening, like people are discovering it. Like the Whitney's buying a work now, acquiring something, fingers crossed. That's incredible to be entered into the, you know, the Whitney American Art Collection.
The mission is just to have his work more widely exposed, more people see it, and it gets in some museum collection just to solidify his reputation. I mean, he'd like to join the pantheon of American artists. That's what I hope will eventually happen.
I think it definitely will happen.
It is happening. I mean,
yeah, it really is. And it's amazing how timing is such an important thing with art, and how, like, and sometimes artists do get to see. I remember that story of Alice Neal as well, who was also making portrait paintings at a time when it wasn't as popular within the gallery system. And I think even she was ignored until maybe 1970 or a bit later, maybe for a long time. And it's really interesting that now when you think of Alice Neal, it's such a iconic name. And for me, I think Larry Stanton will also, you know, be that and is becoming that in our age, which is a really wonderful thing.
My age, I don't expect to be working with it much longer, but never know.
Well, we're very grateful you spoke with us. You know, one of the things that I found so magical about the archive in a way that you ended up protecting was things like the Roland Tech film, Thunder Every Day, that, you know, these kind of Super 8 films from Fire Island and the kind of documentation of that era, because you often hear about it as a narrative and then people even recreate it a bit like Russell just has in American Horror Story because he's gone to Fire Island and actually filmed there. But I loved the actual real footage and how alive and joyous and happy and experimental everyone was at that time. Did you actually work with Roland Tech? Because he's obviously a very important filmmaker of the 90s, that kind of queer filmmaking.
I was looking for someone to do a documentary, and someone introduced him to me, and I wanted somebody who really liked the work, and he did. And we had to raise him some money so he could make that, which he did from all those films that Larry took. But all those films are now in the hands of this Peter Spears, who's a well-known director. He did Call Me By Your Name.
Oh, wow.
Nomadland, and he's a producer. He wants to do a film now, and he says he can raise the money. Roland Tech says he needs another $180,000. We just don't have that.
Then maybe that's what we need to put out there from people listening to podcasts, the fundraising, to get in contact somehow and fundraise.
The director he got for this allegedly Jimmy Made film is the director who shot Andy Warhol Diaries.
Yeah, love that. So, what do you think it is, Arthur, asking you about, as New York, as Manhattan, as a place, why historically it's always pulled in a really creative, queer narrative? What do you think it is about the city?
I think the anonymity that you can get. I mean, New York has probably the biggest gay population in America, including San Francisco, which my guess would be the second biggest place. And, I mean, he had his apartment here. He had Henry Gelzer here. I came back. He had Alice. And I think it's amazing that he was able to get so many kids to come back and pose for him. I I mean, they didn't know that may be the last thing they ever did.
You've also met, like, there's lots of stories I've been reading about how you've met, like, Liberace, these iconic people. You went to a party honoring Iris Murdoch and W.H. Auden, the writer poet. And I mean, there was a funny line that David, I've heard about this, but David said that, you know, W.H. Auden was known for his very lined face. And he turned to you and he said, if that's what his face looks like, imagine what his scrotum is. Yeah. I was like, you know, you say that he's got an amazing sense of humor. You could just imagine that. But that time, I mean, we hear all these names. Me and Rob are bringing these names up, but these are icons of history, of pop culture. Mm-hmm. And you were rubbing shoulders with them. You were like friends with them.
Yeah. Because we had this house at Far Island. And because David and Henry spent two summers there, we had a visitor, we had Robert Mapplethorpe. We had Paul Getty, do you remember the one who lost his ears when he
Yes.
He was there. Paul Newman's
they made
son
the movie about him.
Was gay, his son with his first wife. He came and stayed. I mean, there were a lot of people that were well known. And this one guy who was sort of ditzy, who was older, came over to Henry and David and said, you should put your support behind a gay art Olympics. And David and Henry thought that was hilarious. What artist can jump higher? What artist can...
What gay artist can? What gay... yeah, yeah.
And actually, Henry was the commissioner for the Venice Biennale for the American artists, I think in the mid-60s maybe.
Yeah,
some, I can't remember when exactly.
Hired by Mayor Koch to be the cultural commissioner for the city of New York.
Well, this has been amazing. We ask every guest, we have three questions that we get and ask every guest at the end. And this, I'm really excited to ask you these. But you're a collector of art, obviously, but these feel like things that have personally come to you in your collection, your works by Larry, the glass works you were describing from a boyfriend who was making them before. It feels like you have acquired art in your life via loves. Do you collect art outside of interactions? Oh, really? Is it something?
I mean, I've had these collections because it just turned out that a lot of my boyfriends were artists of one kind or another.
You've got a type.
you love creative souls.
But if you could.
I didn't know about it when I met them, but it turned out even my current boyfriend does art, which I think is terrific.
If you could have if you could do an art heist and you could steal any artwork in the world and you could live with it and look at it every day, do you know what that artwork would be?
Well, it would be one of David Hawkins.
And would it be one that had you in or Larry in or Henry in, or would it be?
Landscape.
That's so extraordinary. Yeah. I love his landscapes.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's more interesting than portraits. He's done of people, although they're amazing. He had a portrait show here, and I was really amazed. Andy Warhol had a retrospective at the Met. It was followed by a retrospective of David's work. And I was there for David's work, and I overheard the guards talking. I thought the show was just absolutely glorious. Anyway, these two Met guards were talking. One of them said, this is a terrible show. The other one said, the worst we've ever had. I said, yeah, people don't leave. They stay. In the Andy Warhol show, people walk through. It was so much easier. But they come into this thing, they actually stand and look at the painting. It's terrible.
Oh, wow.
It's all
That's
subjective.
A great review.
All subjective, isn't it? All art is.
Yeah, David Hockney draws so many people in. Like, it's like, I saw it at the Tate myself. They're so magnetic, his paintings. You just want to, you feel like you're in the painting or something, or taken to that time, you know.
Well, especially the showers, you know, the shower paintings. And
they're the ones you want to get in, are they, Russ?
100%. I want to be in them showers, yeah.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
Blue, I guess.
You're wearing right now.
You're wearing blue now. But what is it about? And your eyes are sparkling blue as well. I can see on the Zoom. What is it about blues, you think?
I don't know if there's any reason for one's preferences. One just has preferences. Like some people like dark hair, some people like blonde hair. It's just a preference.
What is the best advice that you've ever received when it comes to, you know, the protection of Larry's work? Have you had a lot of advice over the years of what to do with the work or how to place it? Or,
well, Charlie Coles, who had the gallery where we had his after death show, said I should just get the work out there. David said, no, hold on to it. If the work goes, you'll never be able to get it back for another show. So I couldn't get it out anyway because nobody was interested in buying it. It was kind of fate that I was left with it till the 80s when it finally began to sell. I sold a lot online. I must have sold 1,000 works online.
But do you feel, is there anything about you now that sort of wishes you hadn't, you'd followed that different advice then, that you hadn't sold as much and you did have more work now, or are you quite content with the fact that it's...
I'm satisfied that it's out there. Who knows? I mean, 88, how long do you go on after that? So I didn't want to die and leave these works to somebody else where they might disappear. And then I had all that glasswork over Richard, and that was difficult. I sent it to a couple of auction houses, and they said, we don't sell work of people we haven't heard of. I said, it's beautiful. I mean, isn't that really a test of art, whether it's beautiful or not? Who cares about who made it?
Well, we can do a post on Richard's. What was his name?
Richard Gallo. Yeah, I think he has a website, but...
All right, we do. We can talk about
that. You can't really sell on it because the stuff is so heavy. The last time he came back to the United States was probably 20 years ago. And when he got off the plane, they wouldn't let him into the country. He had his visa. He had his documents because he was HIV positive. He had all the right paperwork, but they wanted to know if he had sold work here. His visa allowed him to make work here, but not to sell it. So he's standing in front of this agent, and he wants him to prove that he's never sold anything. Well, you can't prove a negative. So they put him in handcuffs, put him in leg irons, and took him to jail in New Jersey. The next day, they put him back on the plane for Brazil. They wouldn't even allow him to call me. But he did say they took him out to the plane. He was still in leg irons and handcuffs. They explained to the pilot what his story was, and the pilot actually came back and said, gave him their apologies and said how sorry they were, and then with the rest of the plane heard, they all gave him a pound of applause, which was sort of nice, but you can't prove a negative. It's impossible.
Well, this has just been amazing talking to you. Thank you for finding time, Arthur. It's an absolute privilege. For everyone listening, there is an amazing Instagram feed. It's Larry_Stanton_art on Instagram. And if you go on that, you can currently see the pictures of the installations in the Acne stores. There's images from inside your apartment. There's images like historical archive images. There's recent works. There's, you know, there's exhibitions popping up all over the place. There was work in a show in London recently. It's everywhere. And then Daniel Cooney Fine Art on Instagram. That's an amazing feed. He's representing the estate as well as yourself. Fabio running the Larry Stanton Estate Instagram feed, right? So you can talk to Fabio if there's any ideas or things that you want to communicate about Larry's work.
You can also get Larry Stanton, Think of Me When It Thunders, which is a beautiful, beautiful book, monograph, which has images of Larry's work. And it was published by Appartamento, who are obviously the amazing magazine as well. And you can get it from their website, appartamentomagazine.com. And I think it's about 45 euros, and they ship worldwide. So I really recommend buying that book.
It's beautiful.
We printed 2,000 copies. I think we've sold about 1,000. Acme says they want to buy 1,000 as giveaways at their various location. Whether that'll happen or not, but that'll push us easily into a second printing.
Wonderful. Well, also, every single Talk Art listener right now is going to get online and buy the book.
Yes. So
let's sell it out.
Yes. And let's hope the Whitney makes that acquisition soon so we can all see Larry part of an institution like that.
Arthur Lambert, thank you so much. You are such a generous, wonderful human being. And thank you for protecting art and also just being a philanthropist in the sense that you support so many artists.
Patronage.
And we love that. Mm-hmm. You're a legend. We absolutely love you. And we're so grateful that you spent this hour with us.
Well,
so thank you for sharing your story. I know it was very emotional for you. And we're very, very grateful that, that you went through all those.
I lost Larry, of course, my two closest friends. My brother, my nephew, I mean, it was just like a huge wipeout of my life. So sad.
Well, thank you so much, Arthur. This has been wonderful. And long live Larry Stanton's work. We're going to be seeing this come more and more into focus internationally now. And it's a real privilege to talk to you about it.
Have you seen my photo book?
Your photo
book? Yes, you made a photo book with Larry.
Oh,
and it's like 109 pages of all of these beautiful young men. And you photographed that one pre-AIDS. Yeah.
Yes, I've seen that publication. It's Daniel Cooney gave me that. It's an amazing publication as well.
I think that's out of print at the moment, so we need to get that in reprint for people. It's fantastic.
Just go to Amazon. They have it. I go to Amazon. You can buy a used copy in perfect condition.
Amazing. We direct everyone there. Thank you.
We'll be back very soon. Thanks, Arthur. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from JELD-WEN. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on JELD-WEN windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.